What do you think of American Werewolf in Paris? Because I'm a little bit of an American Werewolf in Paris apologist.
Really?
I can't defend the CGI, but there's, like, I kind of like the idea of, like, Euro-nationalists having, like, werewolf raves. There's something about that that I like. Welcome to another episode of Jabber on the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. I am Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California. Keith Foster, the regular co-host of this program, is not here today. And in his place, I brought on a special guest. This is Brandon Hall from Pocatello, Idaho, still?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All right. Now, this is kind of an interesting snippet, a little background history into how I know you, how you ended up on the show. You were actually a professor of mine at one point.
Yes, I will confirm that. That is accurate.
The second time I took a history of film, or what is it, film survey?
We call it art of film.
The art of film, that's
the
right.
The clumsiest name we could find.
The second time I took the class was with you, and I think it was pretty close to my last semester. I think I only maybe, if it wasn't that, it was the semester right after.
The semester and, right after your last semester?
No, the semester before my last semester,
yeah,
I think. And me and Keith were actually in your class at the same time.
Yes, absolutely. Both standout students.
I was going to pressure you and ask you if we were the best students, but
absolutely.
I probably don't want to know the answer to that.
Oh, absolutely. I think you both got 105% or something like that, which says a lot about both of us, really.
So. Right. We kind of got to know each other better through Facebook, I think. And, you know, on top of talking about movies, obviously, I moved here down to Southern California to go to film school and get a master's in something I can't use. And sure.
That's what they're for. That's what they're for.
That's what liberal arts degrees are for. Debt collection, mostly.
For sure. Although there's no master's degree in debt collection, I'm pretty sure.
No, isn't that
just
ironic?
A certification.
And we kind of got to talking on Facebook and talking about movies and that kind of stuff. Also music. We're both big music geeks, I think.
Sure. Yeah, that's fair.
If I can impose that title on you.
Sure. Sure. I'm a special guest and a music geek, so that's pretty good for one day.
Yeah, I think you're the only person who might appreciate my long-running gag on this podcast that completely goes over all my other co-hosts' heads of trying to compare every genre of horror to a subgenre of metal.
Oh, nice. I don't know. It might not be a joke. We might legitimately argue about it.
Yeah. Well, we don't get too stuck in the weeds there, but we'll see what happens. So just so people kind of get an idea, a little bit to know more about you. Sure. How long have you been teaching film, and are you still?
Yeah, I teach it about once a year. Well, about. I teach it every year in the spring, usually.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we started we've had the course offering on the books for a long time, but we started offering it quite a bit more regularly once it became suitable as an objective class, you know, a general ed requirement. And it right. now fills the same slot as the lit class, also the theater class and philosophy class. So you can imagine lots of film students all of a sudden.
Right, right. I know there was an art of film too.
Mm-hmm.
It never like came around during a slot in my schedule where I could take it. But
that is not surprising.
Yeah, it was always like every other semester, like either like really late in the day or a night class or something like that, or an early in the morning before I would be willing to wake up. I never was able to take the second version of it, which is why I ended up just taking the first one over again, just to kind of fill a spot towards the end of my my bachelor's degree. But how do I want to word this exactly? How did you end up getting into the study of film? Did you take like a film survey course or something like that, or did you kind of just land on this because you were interested?
Yes and yes. Yeah, I took some film classes as a bachelor in Moscow, University of Idaho, which has a pretty good creative writing program and also an international film studies program. So I did pick up some classes that way. As far as teaching it, I can't remember if the prior instructor literally died in the middle of a semester or was, for whatever reason, that's probably privileged information, let go. and so I can't remember. It was a mid-season replacement that they shipped me into. So I learned the hard way. But after that, you know, you sort of default into nobody else wants to teach it. And at the time, film was in that position for some reason. I don't know why it seemed. Now it's very popular. Most of our instructors try to get the class. So I don't know. It was kind of a luck of the draw thing. But as a person, obviously, I've been pretty interested in film, like everyone, like most people have been most of my life. And so I came at it as a, you know, self-studying amateur for the most part.
Well, I think that's where all of us start, right? I mean, there's like the old story of like Quentin Tarantino works at the video store, and that's quote unquote his film school.
Yeah, exactly, and that's even more germane than most of our experience. So
yeah, you're sort of creating your own curriculum that way. You're sort of, you know, and I did my alma mater was also at K&B Video Store.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Which is still in business.
Is that still there? That is still there. Wow. Okay.
Yep.
Good for them. Good for them.
And the gas station across the street has generously not put a red box in, so it's still going.
Wow. I wonder if they actually worked out an agreement for that, if it just kind of went that way.
I don't know. That's lucky, though. When I do teach the film class and I, you know, most of the films are available in various formats, there's always the instant rush to get to K&B Quick Stop, the only video store around, to get copies of things.
Right. Yeah. Which is like, that's an experience that's completely foreign to a lot of people.
Yeah. It's sad.
I mean, I watch these like YouTube videos of people like finding a lone Blockbuster or a lone this or that. And then they walk in, they're like, oh my God, I feel like a kid again. And it's like, it wasn't that long ago. I mean, I know that it was, you know, technology's changed a lot very rapidly, but it's within pretty recent memory that these existed.
To be fair, most of them literally were kids the last time there was a video store around.
Maybe, but still. Maybe, yeah. I was supplementing my college income working at a video store, so maybe my perspective is a little skewed.
Perhaps.
Just so everybody knows what we're doing this episode, we will be reviewing the film Venom as our main review. At the end of the program, we're going to do the Netflix homework, which you assigned me, The Ritual, a Netflix original film. And before we get onto all of that, we are going to do another horror movie draft. This time we're going to be doing horror films of the 1980s. Yeah, let's go ahead and just jump into that.
Yeah, sounds good.
Now, we talked about this a little bit on off air about, you know, the 70s versus the 80s. We just did an episode on the 70s. And I think the key difference to me between the decade, the 70s kind of ushered in the prestige horror film. I suppose, like, you know, Night of the Hunter and Psycho and things like that existed as well, that maybe sort of predates that. But with the movie brats and the new Hollywood movement and everything sort of picking up all of these, what was traditionally seen as B-movie material genres, we started to see sort of the elevation of the B-movie into A-movies. And that, in my mind, is what a big part of what 70s horror is about, is sort of that perspective plus horror. And then you also had like exploitation films and Italian films and all of that kind of stuff going on as well. But to me, the difference is between that and the '80s, the '80s is sort of the rise of the pop horror film.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, to loop back to what we were talking about earlier, undoubtedly driven by the VHS market.
Yes. Which was new at the time. And as well as the rise of special effects that weren't possible before. So we start to see a lot more sort of fantasy-driven horror in and surreal horror happening in the 80s, as opposed to, you know, the guy in the woods, which there's plenty of that as well, and plenty I'm sure we'll talk about.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, Star Wars kind of paved the way for all kinds of things. In terms of that, I mean, and peak practical effects work, really. I mean, some into the mid-90s, but even by then, mostly we're talking about the 80s.
Yeah, for sure. And, like, different kinds of plastics and rubbers have never been used before. And this is, like, when you start to have sort of the rock star creature designers or the makeup effects guys like Rob Bottin and Rick Baker and these kinds of people who kind of become names in and of themselves, even though they're behind the camera, even behind the director. So
and then I occasionally directing films, some of which are terrible.
Some of which, yeah. You know, I kind of, it's not an 80s film, but I kind of appreciate Tom Savini's remake of Night of the Living Dead.
Tom Savini was who I exactly had in mind. Although that one is great, but Children of the Living Dead, not as great.
Fair enough. Fair enough. All right, cool. So you listened to our 70s episode. You kind of get an idea of how we're going to do this. I will say a name of a movie, at which point you will have to cross it off your list if it overlaps. And we'll go back and forth like that till we have a list of 10. And actually, I'll let you go first. What movie do you want to talk about now?
Sure. Could I make a quick plug for two 70s movies that I was sad to see not on your list?
Oh, go ahead. I was sad to see a lot of movies that didn't go on our list.
Yeah. Well, you covered most. I mean, I liked the list, and I was really excited to see Ken Russell on there.
I always have to give big ups to The Devils. Any excuse to talk about that crazy movie?
All of his movies are just the best, the best crazy movie. But Black Christmas, I thought, was specifically missing as a, you know, a genre-originating sort of film, a proto-slasher, even before some of the others you mentioned.
For sure.
Yeah. And then the Japanese film Houshu, I thought, was also sadly missing.
Houshu didn't make my list only because I hadn't seen it, and I wouldn't know exactly what to say about it. I've heard good things. I plan on seeing it. Maybe I'll see it this fall. I always try to make a point in October to see horror movies I've never seen before. Sure. And Black Christmas didn't make my list because of the Christmas factor.
Yeah, well, that's fair. And that's fair.
I know that it is like, you know, very, it is like essentially like the first slasher film, like that and Blood and Black Lace.
Right.
Pretty early on.
Bird with Crystal Plumage and some of the others. From
Peeping Tom. There's like the proto slashers. But yeah, what do we have for the first film of the 80s?
Okay. So my top few, you know, they're all the same. They're in value to me. So I assume this will be on your list, but I don't know. I'm going to go with the best film beyond horror film of the 80s, almost. Split decision between a few things, but I'm going to go with The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing from 1982.
Yeah. Yep. That's definitely on my list. And one of the first ones that came to mind when I think of 80s horror. For me, and I don't know, maybe you agree with this, maybe you don't. To me, when you talk about John Carpenter and you talk about his legacy, it's especially when you're talking about his horror films, because he made other genres.
Sure.
But he's probably most well known for his horror films. I think of The Thing and then there's Everything Else, which isn't to disregard Everything Else because, you know, there's a lot of like definitive decade defining movies. Even underneath that. But if you're talking about what I think is the height of everything he was capable of doing and like, you know, the biggest statement of what he was as an auteur, as a director, it's The Thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Halloween is great for what it is, and it's a different kind of animal altogether. But like you said, if you're talking about everything John Carpenter can do in one place, yeah, The Thing, absolutely. They Live, Big Trouble in Little China, lots of fun, but not quite the same sort of thing.
Right, for sure. And the makeup effects in that movie and the creature effects, the puppetry still holds up to this day. There was that kind of Dead in the Water remake that came out, 2013 or something like that?
Sounds right. Somewhere around there.
Yeah. And, you know, CGI all over the place, and otherwise it's fine. But to see that, you know, the puppet effects in a film from 1982, I believe, right?
Yeah, I think that's the date.
If those effects are still outdoing your 2013 CGI, that's saying a lot about the movie.
Yeah, and I mean, have you read the source material?
I haven't. I've seen Thing from Another World, the original John Hawks, or not right. John Hawks, Howard Hawks version. But I have not seen or read the original short story. That I know that Carpenter went more for that rather than a remake of the Hawks film.
Yeah, it's John Campbell, I want to say. I believe it's John Campbell, but his short novella, Who Goes There? It's really, it is really pretty faithful. And a lot of the stuff, if you're just reading it, you'd say, there's no way to make this into a film. But that, you know, clearly it isn't impossible to make it into a film. And they did a great job with it. The character of MacReady obviously has some Kurt Russell-ish flair to it, but it's essentially there on the page, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. And it's a fairly dark film, too. I think everyone kind of thinks of it now as sort of a given that everyone loves this movie, but it didn't do very well in its initial release. And one of the reasons why is because it's extremely bleak and has a very bummer ending. And I think it took a while for people to sort of like warm up to that, so to speak.
Yeah, sure. Kids were all still sad from Empire Strikes Back. They're not ready for that.
Fair enough. Okay, what do I want to go with now? I'm looking at my short list here. Yeah, I'll get this one out of the way.
All right.
Poltergeist.
Yeah, I have that on there too.
And this is another one that I think critics were sort of mixed on when it came out. This was produced by Steven Spielberg and directed by Tobe Hooper of Texas Chainsaw fame. And there's some discrepancy over like how much did Tobe Hooper direct and did how heavy of a hand was Steven Spielberg's influence, because it feels very much like one of his films more so.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a lot considerably darker than the average Steven Spielberg movie. And there's some pretty gruesome gore effects and stuff that happened in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember last time we talked about how Amityville Horror was such a huge influence on what like the Blumhouse films that are being made now, these sort of like haunted house thrillers. And I think The Poltergeist maybe even more so, or, you know, sort of a concentration of both.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, the first Insidious film has really obvious pastiches as far as Poltergeist goes, or maybe homages, but certainly the Ghost Hunter characters are all from Poltergeist almost directly.
Yeah, that idea. And I think that was captured a lot of people's imaginations from that first Poltergeist film, is the idea of like the of a psychic or a medium or something like that. We had The Exorcist, which was their whole thing is to like defeat the devil. And in this one, it's this whole idea of like ectoplasm and alternate realities and, you know, all of this kind of more fantastical ghost hunting stuff.
Yeah, and it doesn't get cooler than Zelda Rubinstein.
No, yeah, she's great. She's fantastic. And I actually like maybe this is the Spielberg thing. I really like the family dynamic between all of them. Everybody has a very distinct personality, and everybody sort of brings something to it. You know, all of their fears are kind of played upon in really interesting ways throughout the movie. And it's this whole idea of like, I want to say maybe one of the first like haunted house films that takes place in the suburbs.
Oh boy. Yeah, probably. I mean, I'm sure there are others, but certainly major one.
Yeah. That really kind of popularized that idea and sort of modernized the haunted house motifs.
Yeah, I mean, and with especially with the television being an integral part of the plotting.
All right.
And any movie that can make me enjoy watching Craig T. Nelson is pretty impressive.
What about The Incredibles?
All right, fine. Any non-animated movie.
Okay, what do you have next?
All right. So I'm going to go with my split choice for number one, which is probably my favorite movie of all time, American Werewolf in London.
Oh my God, I forgot to put that on my list, but it's an obvious one.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, what can you say that hasn't been said, right? Go ahead and say what hasn't been said.
I'm sure I'm not going to say anything that hasn't been said before, but yeah, another great practical effects movie, genre bending. You know, I think maybe the idea of like it being a horror comedy is a little overstated. I think it's pretty full on horror, with a bit of a sense of humor, but I wouldn't say that it, you know, other than the scene maybe in the Piccadilly Circus where he's running around naked, that's the only scene that feels to me like a traditional comedy. The rest of the film, I think, is, you know, it certainly has some like gallows humor, but I love that movie. I think it, you know, for my money, probably still the best werewolf movie.
Oh, sure. 100% on that. I mean, not a ton of competition, but still fantastic. Dog Soldiers, maybe, but great stuff. And the color palette, the cinematography, I mean, it looks amazing. It's just got that great sort of green palette to it.
Mm-hmm. And I think it introduced this idea into the werewolf lore, or maybe it existed in something before, you can tell me. This idea of like, the people that you kill as a werewolf like haunt you and torture you until you have to kill yourself.
Yeah, there's a literary precursor to that, but as far as film, I don't think it shows up in The Wolfman. As far as I mean, he's tortured by being a werewolf, but not literalized in the same way that it is in American Werewolf.
And that's actually like, it starts out being funny. And then as the movie progresses and they get more and more sort of decomposed when he sees them, I think it's actually pretty chilling. Again, it's another one that sort of ends on a down note.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think of American Werewolf in Paris? Because I'm a little bit of an American Werewolf in Paris apologist.
Really?
Yeah, I can't defend the CGI, but there's like, I kind of like the idea of Euro nationalists having like werewolf raves. There's something about that I like.
Okay. Well, then let's see. I guess how I would place them in context next with each other is that American Werewolf in London works because the characters are so sympathetic. All of them, the nurse, his friend, David, they're just great. And so everything that happens is multiplied by, you know, the attachment I had to the characters. Whereas I never felt, I don't even remember who the characters in American Werewolf in Paris are.
Yeah.
So I guess I don't have any fondness for it, but I was probably 35 when I saw it, 30 something. So, you know, that could be part of it.
Yeah. You have no dog in that hunt, as to say.
Oh, the dog will often hunt, but not that time.
Okay, for my next one, I'm going to go with the original Evil Dead.
Okay, well, this is going to be a thing then.
Oh, okay.
Not really.
I'm excited for the thing, whatever it is.
Well, I mean, there's two things, I guess. One is the film was originally filmed in the 70s as opposed to the 80s. But it was released in the 80s, so it really you could call it either one, I'm sure. Just fine.
Mm-hmm.
But the more important thing is that over Evil Dead 2, huh?
Yeah. And first of all, I'm the guy who I prefer Night of the Living Dead over Dawn of the Dead.
All right.
And if we're, you know, get really deep into the woods, I prefer Day of the Dead to Dawn of the Dead, which I know is like sacrosanct to a lot of people. But one of the reasons that I like Evil Dead more than Evil Dead 2 are sort of for similar reasons. I think it's more pure in its intentions. I think that the minimalist nature of it, the super low budget, and the way that he works around that, the kind of idea of like student film-esque quality to it. And I think that first one is again, if we're talking about comedy horror as a genre or whatever, that one is a little bit more kind of darkly humorous, and the sort of the humor sort of comes more from an uncomfortable place. Whereas Evil Dead 2 and then Army of Darkness in the 90s is much more like outwardly zany. And I appreciate those for what that is. And Evil Dead 2 is also on my list, but I decided to go with this one because I think that as a statement in horror, it is more satisfactory to me. And I think that it's had a long, like, that film existing has affected future low budget horror, you know, the Peter Jackson films, mm-hmm. etc., more so than the fact that they made a pretty cool sequel later.
Okay. I mean, I'll buy that argument. I guess I'd argue that I think Evil Dead 2 more directly influenced things like cinematography and approaches to pacing and things like that in Peter Jackson, certainly the Coen brothers, mm-hmm. folks like that, in a way that Evil Dead probably did on a more intimate level, sort mm-hmm. of a viewing among friends and auteurs sort of level. I think Evil Dead 2 had a big, more widespread effect, doing the same things, but more intensely. But, you know, they're both great movies. I mean, choosing one isn't really getting rid of anything bad. They're both great, so mm-hmm. I'll buy mm-hmm. it.
And I love Evil Dead 2. I just think that, you know, this kind of goes back to my thing with Last House on the Left versus The Hills Have Eyes. Like, The Hills Have mm-hmm. Eyes is a better movie if you're just talking about technical, you know, where the camera is and how the editing works and characters and da-da-da. But I think that Last House on the Left is a more important statement in overall cinema.
Yeah, I mean, I'll go with that. Last House on the Left is a loathsome movie.
No, yeah, it's like, awful.
Like Keith was saying, I can't tolerate the movie. But,
no.
But yes, important. whereas and, Evil Dead I love, so
that's yeah, and you can watch those, are perennial for me. So and going back to our other conversation, would you be comfortable classifying this as a death metal film? Because to me this is pretty death metal.
What, Evil Dead 2 or Evil Dead?
The Evil Deads. Less so Army of Darkness.
Yeah, less so. We can all just agree, less so Army of Darkness. well, I can tell you that literally there are plenty of death metal songs about Evil Dead.
There you go.
So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you've got Deicide doing a song, Skinny Puppy doing a song, Death the Band doing a song, I think you can clarify that it's a death metal movie.
Thank you. I feel validated.
There you go.
What is your next pick?
Okay, well, let's see. Where do I want to go next? Maybe shifting in tone and just going for importance in cinema, I will chuck out there Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Oh, interesting. This didn't occur to me. For some reason in my head, I saw this as a 90s film. What year did this come out?
I want to say mid to late 80s somewhere.
86.
86, yeah.
I'm looking it up right now. Yeah, for some reason, I thought it was like 91 or something like that. I was way off.
Well, I mean, it is ahead of its time for sure. And that's why I think it's important. It really established this, you know, method of storytelling for horror films that I can't think of an example earlier. Peeping Tom, kind of, mm-hmm. but not really.
Maybe Manhunter? I think that actually maybe came out a year or so later.
Yeah, and Manhunter's bleh. I mean, it's mediocre at best.
I think it's a better Michael Mann movie than it is like a horror movie, but
yeah. But, I mean, they're just, Henry does so many things as far as commentary on media and celebrity. I guess it's kind of pre-Natural Born Killers in some mm-hmm. ways, too. But the verite part of it is what really stuck, I think.
Yeah, that's the stuff that's especially hard to watch. Now, it's interesting that you just said that Last House on the Left is a really
difficult
film.
I think I see where you're going.
This film, which is pretty sadistic. And it stars Michael Rooker, who everyone probably knows now as Yondu from the Guardians of the Galaxy films.
Right.
Or if you're a little bit older, the so-and-so's dad from Mallrats.
Right. But, or a villain from Slither, which is also a good
James Gunn flick. But yeah, this was him early on. Very brooding, very Travis Bickle-y, I guess, kind of in mm-hmm. in the sort of first person perspective of the film and sort of the troubled mind, although a lot more pushing that further. This is a really interesting film to me because it like it's that mid 80s indie, like pre Miramax indie kind of thing, mm-hmm. where it's a little bit of an art film, it's a little bit of an exploitation film, and it's a little bit of kind of like a sophisticated thriller all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was absolutely a tape swap film in its day. I mean, that's how we all watched it. Sort of someone recorded it off of some premium cable channel.
Yeah, and if like Last House, when you're watching it, it feels like something you shouldn't be watching. Mm-hmm. Like you could get in trouble for mailing this to somebody. yeah, I think the first time I heard about it was in the Horror Hound book. And somebody said that it was the most accurate or the most chilling portrait of a serial killer or the inside, you know, mind of a serial killer or something like that. And we all watched it huddled around our TV in the living room, me and my college friends. And we all just had that feeling like, OK, well, that was that. Now let's go try and carry on with the rest of our day.
Yeah, it is pretty nasty. I mean, it's funny that you call it accurate because obviously it's based, quote unquote, based on Henry Lee Lucas. Mm-hmm. But it's absolutely, I mean, Henry Lee Lucas is a, you know, mentally challenged, obnoxious, filthy, gross sort of Michael Rooker. He's not, you know, he comes across pretty well. He's the Hollywood version of Henry Lee Lucas.
Right.
But it's nonetheless, it's still particularly chilling and revolting and seemingly real.
Mm. Yeah, and like you were saying, the verite aspects of it, especially the stuff we see from the video camera that they buy in the movie. And yeah, and that stuff absolutely is, I think, a direct visual reference to Peeping Tom.
Yeah.
Which is a 60s film. But
absolutely. The scene where obviously, I mean, the scene that everyone brings up, where they're watching, you're watching the violence, a couple of murders on screen, and then we pull back and they're watching it while the bodies are on the floor, and it's really nasty. And in real life, then they went off for blowjobs after that, but, you know, not in the movie.
Like you do.
Like you do, like one does. Yeah, it reminds me of sort of where things like Bad Lieutenant went in about 5 years from then.
Okay, so for my next pick, I'm really torn. Because I want to go with a specific director, and I have three of his movies on here, but I don't know which one I want to do. Do I want to go with the one that probably is the more important movie, or the one that has more of a legacy, or do I want to go with a personal favorite? Okay, I'm going to go with personal favorite, just because I think as time goes by, this movie becomes more and more relevant.
Sure.
And that is David Cronenberg's Videodrome.
Okay, yeah. Yep, go on.
And I could have said The Fly, and I could have said The Dead Zone. All three are great movies. There's a good argument for Dead Ringers as well, although I tend to think that bit is more of a drama. Videodrome is a perfect encapsulation of what I think 80s horror was in terms of reinterpreting a genre thing through this new sort of technology that's coming about, sort of commenting on the way that technology changes. Specifically, we talked about the introduction of VHS. And then, of course, this would have a huge influence later on like the Japanese horror films like The Ring. This him bringing these sort of surrealism elements into it and sort of playing with the new plastic realities through these new kinds of latexes and rubbers and stuff that people are using at the time. And the way that all three of those things, or however many things I said just now, are working in synergy to create sort of something like we've never seen before. And even to this day, if we just want to go on anecdote, on one of my birthdays, I had all my friends come over, we watch movies, and I decided to do a double feature of Phantom of the Paradise, which is one of my favorite cult films.
Sure.
Brian De Brian De Palma's Phantom of the Paradise, which is like a fun, kind of campy, gothic horror-ish musical, rock and roll musical. And then we had like intermission, and then we sat down and watched Videodrome. And most of my friends hadn't seen it before. And I kind of knew what I was doing a little bit. And by the end of the movie, everybody just kind of walked out silently. And the last guy was like, happy birthday, and just closed the door behind him.
Yeah, that's what you want. That's a solid ending.
And I knew that I did it right. What's your relationship to this movie? And where does it rank in your Cronenbergs?
Sure.
Or do you even like Cronenberg?
Number seven, I guess, on my list. I had all three of them. I had mm-hmm. The Fly, Videodrome, and Dead Zone with question marks after them. Mm-hmm. Or Dead Ringers, rather. I like Dead Zone a lot, but Dead Ringers is, oh man, it's a disturbing film. I find it very effective.
It's a bummer, yeah.
But I would have, out of the three of them, I was going to go with The Fly. But I think one Cronenberg's enough. I like The Fly a lot, mostly because Gina Davis is probably my favorite actress of the 80s.
Well, fair enough.
But, you know, Videodrome, The Fly, they're great. I mean, I think you're right. I think you said it well. They encapsulate a lot of things that are changing in the 80s. Attention to technology. Cronenberg gets more obnoxious about it later in something like Existence.
Yeah.
Which is not as watchable by any stretch.
No.
But he's working with the same kind of human stuff that he does in History of Violence and mm-hmm. Some of his other things. So, yeah, I mean, it's very much so in the wheelhouse. I like it. It's a goofy movie. A lot of fun.
That sort of philosophy meets horror, Cronenbergian, very cerebral type stuff is mm-hmm. kind of starts here.
Yeah, I mean, you guys talked about The Brood last time.
Yeah.
And
that,
cool.
That's sneaking up to that, because that's talking about like pop psychology and stuff, but.
Mm-hmm. It's cool to see him evolve from, you know, Rabid, especially stuff like that, Shivers, into something like Videodrome, which is, you know, another layer, another level up. Before I get to the more obscure stuff, I'll just go with what hopefully has to be on at least many people's list, and that is Reanimator, the Stuart Gordon movie. All right. 1985, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess to talk about it for a minute, there aren't very many good and or faithful Lovecraft adaptations, no. As you probably are aware. I mean, there's that H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society silent film version of Call of Cthulhu.
Which is fun.
Yeah, it's fun. There's a German version of Color Out of Space that's pretty good from a while ago. You know, The Thing often gets credited as partially an At the Mountains of Madness remake. But Reanimator is its own separate thing. And actually, although it seems really over the top and insane and not very Lovecrafty, it's pretty faithful to the source material. It leaves out some of the more racist stuff. And mm-hmm. There is no decapitated head giving cunnilingus in an H.P. Lovecraft story, but it works within the tone they've established.
Right. Yeah, that one's, you know, I think it was one of those situations where when I was really young, I was kind of flipping through cable and landed on like IFC when they were showing Reanimator, and they were specifically showing that scene, which is just like, for a 13-year-old brain, like way too much to handle.
It's a lot to digest.
Here. Yeah, like I don't even know what to do with everything that's happening right now. But I kind of thought of it as like this extreme like gore like I've never seen before. Then later on in college, I watch it again and I'm like, no, this is hilarious for one, and in very intentionally so. And I actually think it's just, if you're talking about witty writing, one of the better of sort of this subgenre. And, you know, you could throw in stuff like Evil Dead 2 or the later Peter Jackson movies and that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. It's these sort of like splatstick horror films. I love the characters in it. And it does feel, I think, appropriately zany.
Yeah. I mean, Lovecraft wrote it apparently because he was irritated at the editor, I think Farnsworth Wright, of Weird Tales at the time. Mm-hmm. He submitted some other stories that were serious, and Farnsworth said, no, these aren't going to sell well. Make it, you know, wackier, make it something the public would like. So we wrote it as a condescending sneer to what people thought was, you know, entertainment in the 1930s. And I think it carries a lot of that sarcasm over into the film.
Yeah, for sure. And it kind of feels like a little bit of like a frat house, like style horror film in a way, not just because there's a scene of nudity in it, of which there are many in many 80s horror films. But it also, it feels more, I guess, poppy than anything we've talked about so far.
Yeah, which is especially fun because, you know, Herbert West, the counterpoint to frat culture, is pretty entertaining as a protagonist.
You're right. It's almost like Revenge of the Nerds plus gore.
Yeah, and less rapey.
Surprisingly, yes. All right. Oh, geez, there's so many. Like, this is a really tough Sophie's Choice kind of list because there's so many that I want to make sure get on here. I'm going to say this one just to make sure that it ends up on the list because I'm afraid we'll try to avoid it because it's almost too obvious. Nightmare on Elm Street.
Okay. It wasn't on my list.
Oh, okay. One thing I think is that of all of the like film franchises in horror that like have multi-film, like multi-decade long histories of just sequel after sequel after sequel, I think that the Nightmare on Elm Street films as a whole hold up better than most of them. And that's one of the reasons is, and I was talking before about like how surrealism is sort of entering the horror sphere in the 80s. And this film even more directly because you're dealing in the idea of like dreams and dream logic and those kinds of things. I like to see how a different director sort of approach that as the series goes on. And it, a lot of times it's kind of played for laughs and it gets campy and whatever. But the original here by Wes Craven, I think that as a character and as a concept, the Nightmare on Elm Street thing has become so ingrained in pop culture, like, you know, the Crypt Keeper or Pee Wee Herman or anything like that from, you know, you kind of put Freddy Krueger next to those kinds of characters and people don't really think of him as being scary all that much anymore. But I think if you watch the film with the mindset of this is the first time you've ever seen this, this is the first time it's ever occurred to you that this could exist, it's still a pretty effective horror film. And one of the things that I think makes Freddy a scarier horror villain than, say, you know, any of the masked slashers of the 80s is that he does exist in your dreams. So if you see the movie and then later have a nightmare about Freddy Krueger, you have brought the film into reality through its own film rules.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's obviously the plot of Nightmare on Elm Street 7, Wes Craven's new nightmare.
Yes, which may or may not come up in future lists. We'll
but yeah, I mean, I think when you're talking about sequel for sequel in terms of franchises, definitely, without a doubt, Nightmare on Elm Street is the best franchise as far as that goes. The first one, the third one, the seventh one, Freddy versus Jason, those are all solid films. The rest of them, you know, they're fun ones. Two is really interesting. Four is a lesser version of three. Five and six don't really matter, but that's okay. Roseanne's in there.
And, yes, she is.
But yeah, no, I mean, as far, yeah, they're clearly more artistic than any of the other franchises, if you exclude things like Phantasm and sort of lower rung franchises.
Yes. Now, do you, you sounded a little surprised when I brought this up. Is it like, is it cool to not like now? Is that a thing?
I don't know. I don't know what the kids do now. It was on my list beyond 10, I guess, is what where I was at. It wasn't in my top 10. I couldn't quite put my finger on exactly why. It might be that I'm overexposed to it. I say that, but then I've seen Evil Dead 2 a bazillion times. So I'm not entirely sure what it is that that hasn't grabbed me with the film. I like it. I enjoy it. I appreciate it. But for whatever reason, it's not... just not on my all-star team.
No, I get that. And I think that it has a little bit of that kind of like Star Wars thing where it's like, it's again, it's just so ingrained in pop culture in general that it seems almost too obvious. But to me, this is like a quintessential 80s horror film and like what the decade was about. And sure, like the way that changed sort of the slasher genre into something else. There's things about it that are kind of hokey, but I think charmingly so. And there's some practical effects and some horror stuff, like specifically the rotating room effect. That's still really, really, really impressive.
Yeah, I love the practical effects in the movie, except for Freddy walking down the alleyway and his arm stretching out. That's obviously very silly.
Yeah, a little bit. And people actually talk about that as being like a horror moment for them. But I that one I don't think plays as well. But others in the film, I think, are fantastic.
Yeah, for me, there's just something ineffable about it that I can't put my finger on. It's kind of like Fright Night's not going to make my top 10, despite the fact that I really like it a lot. Maybe some other things, I don't know. Maybe you have a big finale. But there are a few others that kind of were in that same category for me.
Fair enough. What do you got?
What number are we? Is this the last one I got?
This is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. This is your last one, yes.
All right. That's rough. Let's see. Luckily, we've covered almost all of them, so that's good. I think that I'm going to go... last time you mentioned that you'd forgotten to put Suspiria on the list, so I'm going to go with probably Tenebrae out of the Argento films. Maybe Phenomena, because Jennifer Connelly, but it came out in a terrible American version called Creepers, that kind of muddies the waters. But one of those two, or Opera, all three of those were pretty great. And I wanted to make sure Dario got on a list somewhere.
So which one are we going with then?
I think I will go with Tenebrae. That's the one that probably is the most solid as a film.
All right, you're going to have to tell me about it because I've never seen it.
It's kind of... Are you familiar with John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness?
Yes.
It's kind of like that. It's a prototype of that in some ways, about a writer who's writing stuff and the things he writes about are starting to happen and people get murdered in ways similar to his book. It goes in a different direction than In the Mouth of Madness. But in case anyone else hasn't seen it, I won't give all that much of where it goes away. But there are some pretty... the pacing, the cinematography are all really Dario Argento. It's not quite as stylized as Suspiria, but it has amazing dog attacks in it. And it's not quite a giallo, so it scales back from that a little bit and goes in a more cerebral direction. It's pretty entertaining.
All right. Where does this rank in the other Dario movies for you?
It's not quite up to his peak 70s stuff. It's not Suspiria, but it's pretty high up there. It's definitely a cut above sort of Deep Red, Hatchet Murders, and then the stuff that came later, the 90s stuff. So it's pretty solid. It's well up there.
And I feel like I want to go with something real weird.
That fair.
Or like another personal favorite. I think we've talked just about everything in some regard. I'll kind of end on another obvious one. But this one is an obvious one that is still very weird. And that is the first Hellraiser.
Okay.
This is Clive Barker's first film. Before this, he was known as mostly a novelist and a short story writer. He got some money together, found somebody who wanted to make this movie out of one of his short stories. And it's had a million sequels, and I've seen a lot of them. And they don't hold up as well, anywhere near as well in quality as even the Nightmare on Elm Street movies as they degrade. But one of the things that's interesting is like everyone kind of thinks of Hellraiser, and I think probably more people think they saw it than probably actually did. Because most people tend to think of just like Pinhead and the Cenobites and like the whole surrealist hell S&M industrial goth culture thing that's going on. But actually, that's a pretty small aspect of the first movie. The first movie is a lot more of this kind of domestic family drama about a mother who is trying to raise one of her ex-boyfriends from the dead using satanic magic.
Again, as one does.
Like you do. And it has a little bit more of sort of a Telltale Heart, Edgar Allan Poe-ish vibe to it. It's a little bit more of sort of gothic romance than the rest of the series, which just becomes more and more about special effects and rubber and chains and that kind of stuff. Which there's a place for that. I have no problem with all those things. But I think this movie actually, as a genre piece, even though it takes place in the middle of the 80s and it has, some serious shoulder pads going on in the movie, both by the undead and the living, it actually feels maybe more traditional than a lot of the other films that we've been talking about so far as what it's referencing in its literary past.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an interesting film, and it's slimy, goopy, gross, and that's fun. But yeah, no, it does do a great job with a character study for the first 50 minutes, you know, before it really gets going, and it works with it pretty well up through the climax. I enjoy it. My wife was raised in a very religious family, and so her parents would, you know, they could only watch movies that were rated G, rated PG.
Right.
Apparently, the original VHS release of Hellraiser came into the United States unrated, which is something that her parents did let them watch. So her dad comes in, the kids are like 10, 8, 6, puts on Hellraiser, goes upstairs to do whatever, comes back an hour and a half later, they're all traumatized and crying. Right. But they watched the whole thing, so, you know, that says something.
Yeah, and I don't know how you don't know what that is when you rent it. Like, maybe the original cover was, like, very ambiguous. It's just, like, the cube or something on the cover.
But, we thought it was called Hairraiser? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I saw it actually kind of later, and I'm kind of glad that I saw it. Because I don't know if I would have really appreciated the sort of gothic romance aspect of it, or the gothic horror aspects of it, if I had seen it, you know, at around the same time that I'd seen a lot of these other movies. I think people would be surprised at how, I mean, there's some gore, there's definitely some bloodletting, and it gets into it at a point, but there's aspects of it that I think are more romantic than other horror films from this era. And I think maybe that would turn some people off if they're expecting just, like, you know, a Nine Inch Nails video all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, like you said, romantic in the literary sense rather than sentimental.
Right.
Which is kind of like, at the time in the 80s, at school, kids would either read Clive Barker books or Stephen King books. And I was always in the Stephen King book camp. But those movies always have their sentimental core. As opposed to a Clive Barker movie, which you don't expect that from. And so the difference in tone when I was that age, I preferred, you know, Stephen King's approach. But now I think Clive Barker's probably doing more interesting thing.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, there was that whole, like, period of time of, like, these English writers coming into America and sort of taking on fantastic horror genres and then bringing in all this, like, English literary stuff. So you have people like Clive Barker, and you have people like Neil Gaiman, and even in the comic world, like Alan Moore and Grant Morrison, and, like, that whole kind of thing happening. And I kind of place, like, Gaiman and Morrison and Clive Barker sort of in a similar wheelhouse.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm staring at a Clive Barker book that has a Neil Gaiman pull quote on the front of it, and a Neil Gaiman book with a Clive Barker pull quote on the front of it.
Yeah,
so absolutely.
There's a lot of Cure fans in black dusters and teased up hair who was reading this stuff at the time.
Yeah, so thank you for reminding me.
All right, did we do it? Is that the whole list?
I think that's 10, yeah.
Cool. And just to go through these again, we have you with coming in with The Thing, then I say The Poltergeist, and you said American Werewolf in London. I said The Evil Dead, the first one. You say Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. I came in with Videodrome. You with Reanimator. Me with Nightmare on Elm Street. You with Tenebrae. And then me with Hellraiser at the end. Is there any you wanted to mention off your list real quick that we didn't get to talk about?
Sure. I mean, this is a long discussion, but neither one of us had The Shining, which is kind of interesting.
Oh, it is. Oh, my God.
I was
a total overlook.
Overlook. Yes, there you go. Very nice. Lair of the White Worm is great, but, you know, probably not top 10 great.
Yeah.
Motel Hell is great.
Mm-hmm.
The Stepfather with Terry O'Quinn.
That's a good movie, yeah.
Basket Case was at Creepshow.
Mm-hmm.
A few other things along those lines. I think, Eating Raoul, but it's pretty on the border of comedy in a much different way. There's two that, I don't know, always come up in this discussion that aren't, that the genre problem is too big, but Gremlins and Ghostbusters.
Oh, fair enough, yeah. Both movies are definitely horror adjacent, for right. sure. And man, that, I'm mad that The Shining didn't come up now. I mean, to me, that movie's like one of the greatest films of all time. Kubrick is probably my favorite director ever. So that like exists above this list. It's like, you know, shining down on the rest of it. I'm not intentionally doing these puns. They just keep happening. I have The Fly, we didn't talk about, we could have. Day of the Dead, we could have talked about, we didn't. Mm-hmm. I have Near Dark.
Yeah, I have that too.
And I think I had, you know, maybe sort of in that ballpark. I'm a Lost Boys fan. I like the original one a lot. I have Society, which wasn't released until the 90s, but is very much an 80s film. The Hitcher was a really great thriller horror film. Child's Play, which is, I think, more clever than people give it credit for at the time. Serpent and the Rainbow, which is one of my like favorite, lesser known, Wes Craven films. Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, which is basically Tobe Hooper's doing his Gremlins 2 version of the original Texas Chainsaw, wacky, fun chainsaw duels and what have you. And yeah, this is a list that could go on and on and on. And there's a dearth of, masked killers in the wood movies. And neither of us decided to talk about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, what are you going to do? As much as I enjoy the Friday the 13th movies, none of them is a good movie. Not a single one of them is anything a real movie.
There are some that are better than others, but yeah, I think they're all. They're all fairly trashy.
Yeah, you got to wait till the late 90s to get to good backwoods killer movies again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's go ahead and get into our main review.
Sure.
And we're going to talk now about the Marvel-adjacent film, Venom, based upon the Marvel superhero villain. And I feel like there's been a long lead up to this movie, you know, both as an intellectual property and as far as discussions on this podcast has gone. So we've talked a little bit about, as we were seeing the trailers come in, it's like, how bad is this movie going to be?
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually been sort of where we were as far as our optimism goes. It's like, is it going to be Catwoman, like Halle Berry Catwoman bad? Or is it going to be like Ghost Rider bad?
Well, that's a huge range there.
So this is directed by Ruben Fleischer, who also did 30 Minutes or Less and Zombieland. And it's done by Sony Studios. So I suppose they still have some ownership of certain Spider-Man properties because they had owned the Spider-Man IP up until they decide to lend it out to Marvel Studios proper to make Spider-Man Homecoming. So we have a Venom film with no Spider-Man and no mention of Spider-Man.
Except for the second post-credit sequence.
Ish. Yeah.
Ish.
Yeah. And this stars Tom Hardy as the main character, Eddie Brock. He is an investigative journalist living in San Francisco. He's a New Yorker living in San Francisco. He's dating Michelle Williams. And he's trying to find out about different kinds of corruption going on in the city and, like, evil industrialists and that kind of stuff. He runs into Riz Ahmed playing Carlton Drake in the movie, who is sort of this Elon Musk type figure, sort of Elon Musk meets Pharma Bro. He has discovered these alien symbiotes from a NASA crash, and he's learned that these symbiotes can, you know, attach themselves to different living things on Earth. And if there is a successful match with one of these bodies, then perhaps we could explore beyond our stars. And when he starts to do human trials, that's when Eddie Brock gets involved, tries to figure out what's going on, and he comes in contact with one of these aliens, and we have some stuff that actually kind of reminded me a decent amount in style, maybe on purpose, maybe not, of American Werewolf.
Tell me more. I'm going to have to loop back around to that. So what reminded you?
Well, there's this kind of like, there's these, you know, specifically when, like, I think the structure of the film is essentially a werewolf film.
Yeah, like, sure.
If you think of it in this terms, he's kind of cursed with this thing. He's, you know, going in these hot sweats and then, like, you know, doing, like, acting out in public. He doesn't know what's happening to him. He thinks he has some sort of sickness. He blacks out and, you know, this other side of him does crazy things. He wakes up in weird places. So there's a lot of, like, these sort of werewolf movie techniques or motifs that go through. And then, of course, it's a little bit of a superhero film. Like, they try and turn Eddie Brock into a hero because he's still sort of after this bad guy, but then he's Venom, so he's eating people. It's tonally a strange contraption. What did you think of Venom?
Oh, boy. Okay, so I'm going into it, I was in the exact same place that it sounds like you guys were.
Mm-hmm.
Not a huge superhero movie fan, and I haven't followed all of them. I don't know. I haven't seen any Thor movies, etc.
Oh, okay.
I know.
No, it's okay. Yeah, you're coming from kind of a different place, but I appreciate that. I'm interested in what that perspective is.
Sure. I mean, I've seen some. I'm familiar with the Nolan films, obviously, and the Sam Raimi trilogy, Spider-Man and so on. And I have and Guardians of the Galaxy and here and there, but I haven't pursued the full extended universe canon,
right,
or what have you. And so coming into it, I wasn't expecting a ton because superhero movies to me are just everything is fake, so who cares what's happening. But I liked it more than I thought I was going to, I guess, as a starting point. Mm-hmm. And I think almost entirely because Tom Hardy pulled it off pretty well.
Yeah,
although I had problems with him for the first hour.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so is it the accent?
Yes. mean, partly it's the accent. I also thought they went far out of their way to make him, you know, to force you to sympathize with him in the first hour. And he really was pretty unlikable until he had something to play against, which was himself in the voiceover that was my biggest complaint of the entire film.
Yeah, you know, I kind of came around to that. So there's this thing going on in the movie where once he has a symbiote and once he realizes it's, you know, real and he's just not going insane, this voice, the symbiote itself, this alien creature that's attached himself to him that turns him into a superhero, essentially, has its own personality, has its own voice, and they talk to each other very sort of golem-like. Throughout the movie, and they have, like, you know, full-on conversations with each other as they go. This is sometimes played for laughs, and early on it's kind of played for, like, sort of dark humor, horror-ish type stuff. I kind of had mixed feelings on that choice. Now, this is all pretty canon for Venom. In fact, the only thing that really separates this in my mind of it really feeling like a Venom thing is the lack of Spider-Man. So even that stuff, and maybe what this is what you're talking about with them trying to humanize him. It's this, you know, he's down on his luck. He loses his job. He loses his girlfriend, and he all this stuff sort of happens to him at once.
Yeah, so this is, yeah. This and I is, guess part of, for me, what was that didn't work about that was how far in advance those beats were predictable.
Yeah.
Like when he has a choice, if you do this thing, you're going to fuck the thing up. Then you know he's going to fuck the thing up because that's what has to happen for him to be down on his luck enough for the next thing to happen.
Yeah, it's a fairly pedestrian screenplay in that way. This feels to me, and it'll be interesting having this conversation with you as someone who doesn't generally watch or like superhero films, but this feels to me very much like superhero films 2.0. I kind of separate the genre sort of in three eras. There's the Richard Donner all the way to the first Blade movie, let's say, in 98. So mostly Superman and Batman stuff happening between then, and then a lot of like direct VHS stuff. So that was like the first era of like, we're going to attempt to do superheroes on film, and sometimes it worked, most of the time it didn't. And then you have the second era, which is like Bryan Singer's X-Men all the way to the first Iron Man film, which is now we have the special effects to actually do this. And let's try and do this a little bit closer to what the comic books were like, because these directors are now old enough to have read them as kids. But we're going to try and make them sort of serious films to some degree. And then you have what we have now, which is the franchising of superhero films and turning them into movie universes and that kind of stuff. And much better special effects and these kind of giant studio mechanisms that are just sort of pumping these out very factory-like. And, you know, to good effect and bad effect. But this film feels very much more like the 2.0. Like I could have imagined this coming out somewhere between Ang Lee's Hulk and the Ben Affleck Daredevil movie. Like there's something a little hasn't quite caught up to where the genre is now. It's a little scrappier. It's a little little less. It's definitely formulaic as far as the plot goes and the plot beats go, but it feels a little bit more like it's kind of making itself up as it goes, even though all of this stuff, you know, has an antecedent in the comic books. And it does play out very similarly to the Venom books. I don't know if you ever really read that many comic books in the past.
I read an extensive Wikipedia entry today.
So this is a lot like what Venom comics were like. I always thought he worked better as a foil to Spider-Man, and that's where he makes the most sense to me. But whenever Venom had his own comic book, all the problems I have with this movie are the same problems I had with those. There's too many symbiotes. Everyone turns into a Venom at some point, and it's the inner monologue stuff gets goofy. And they never can quite find the tone of whether or not he's a villain or a superhero.
Yeah, I mean, the inner monologue stuff, it's exactly the tone that was the problem. I mean, besides, just to explain what I mean by an earlier point, the fact that Tom Hardy does his own voiceover as far as Venom. He's talking to himself with an alternate Tom Hardy voice. But he chose to go in a Peter Cullen direction. He sounds just like Optimus Prime.
Yeah, there's a lot of effects put on the vocal. It's kind of like echoey and robotic sounding.
Yeah. And any other choice as far as the vocal presentation would have satisfied me. Were it whisperier or scratchier or anything that didn't have that, you know, super villain robot voice to it would have satisfied me. But also, maybe this is part of the comic, but does the Venom symbiote make like Earth pop culture jokes?
That seemed new to me. To me, that felt more like a Ruben Fleischer thing. So, you know, if you've seen Zombieland or those, that kind of tone of that kind of snarky, pop culture savvy, postmodern-y type thing, I felt like that was his influence on this. But, I mean, it's not, and maybe kind of strained through a post-Deadpool thing that's sort of happening right now. I sometimes I was into that, sometimes I wasn't. At a point in the movie, I sort of gave in to its goofiness.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I kind of gave up on the idea that it's going to be a serious movie in any kind of way, and that it's going to, you know, not be predictable. But when I just kind of, like, allowed myself to be on the wacky ride that is this movie, I sort of succumbed to it in a way that I didn't expect to.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, one of the last scenes in the bodega, the deli, where there's a joke conversation and then a good murder. you know, that's effective. That comic pacing works really well. It just seems like that stuff started happening without having earned it in any sort of narrative way. They just settled into it before it had any reason to be established. And this space, I'm like, I guess he's an alien, right?
Mm-hmm.
The symbiote or whatever. So, I don't know. It's just too early, too jokey as far as their relationship. But eventually it works. And I can see where a sequel that starts that way would be more entertaining.
Possibly, yeah. Or if they did decide to integrate him into the regular Spider-Man universe, I don't know if that's an option. I don't know what the legal paperwork or red tape is between that and Sony and Marvel right now, if that could ever happen. But I can actually see this version of Venom in that version of Spider-Man in a way that works. Probably better, honestly.
Yeah, better than Topher Grace, for sure.
Yeah. yeah, for sure. And I like Tom Hardy in the movie. I think he kind of pulls that off. The special effects are pretty mediocre most of the way through. I was actually surprised by, like, and maybe this is another thing that reminded me more of like an early 2000s CG experience. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of pretty under-rendered CGI in this movie. Like, was that just me?
No, I mean, I took that away as well. And some of the action scenes were just framed in a really confusing way, at least for me.
Mm-hmm.
I liked at the end when they're fighting and they're sort of all breaking apart and the everything's fighting everything.
Yeah, that looked cool.
That looked great.
Mm-hmm. And I think when he has the suit on generally and he's, you know, like those shots look fine. But there's like it's stuff that we take for granted, like car crashes or, you know, whip pans and things like that, mm-hmm. where the CGI shows itself in unflattering ways.
Yeah, it really resonated with Dark Knight sorts of a Dark Knight sort of appearance to it.
Yeah, or an attempt of that or something.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. It also I think was filmed for 3D, and so this mm-hmm. happens every once in a while where you see, I always see movies in 2D because I don't want to pay the extra $3 for something I don't care about and a dimmed screen. But a lot of times when you see movies that are shot for 3D and 2D, they don't integrate the CGI as well because it's supposed to pop out anyway. Mm-hmm. So
that makes sense.
I don't know. Maybe the experience is different watching it in 3D, but for me, this is like a surprising C+.
Yeah, C+ is the exact grade I gave it.
Yeah, I was like entertained by it. I can't call it a good movie with good conscience, but I was kind of entertained by it.
Yeah, that's fair. My daughter, who's 13, liked it about the same I did. So
yeah,
it's not an age issue necessarily. But I gotta ask, so for comic guys like you who are watching these movies, so there's a scene like he's got a next door neighbor that plays music really loud.
Yeah.
Because it's a standard sort of setup like that. Mm-hmm. And he goes to the door and the guy opens the door and brushes him off. And then he does a Venom face and the guy says, okay, I'll turn it down. Does that work for you guys that like comic book? That seems like such a predictable sort of 70s thing. Sitcom beat that I don't know how to take that.
Well, again, I think like that kind of stuff, that sort of brattier thing to me is more from the Ruben Fleischer thing. Well, because that's the stuff that reminded me of like some of the, dare I say, hacky humor that I've seen in other movies of his. Mm-hmm. Or like really kind of easy, low-hanging fruit kind of setups. And that's the stuff I didn't know I was going to get going in. But I actually think that accumulatively, that sort of tone sort of helps swallow the rest of this easier. Because sure. I think if it had tried to take itself more seriously and was as predictable as it is and isn't as maybe isn't as sophisticated or as you know, second thought as some of the newer superhero sort of things we're seeing nowadays, I don't think that it wouldn't have felt as sort of carefree and breezy and weirdly entertaining as it ended up being overall. Sure. So yeah, there's a little bit of liking it ironically going on here, but not entirely. Like, I think it's sort of junky, like it's sort of a junk food movie in sort of a good way.
Yeah, I mean, it is breezy and fun, but it's up against a backdrop of like a really inhumane villain. The antagonist is terrible.
Yeah.
And so and part of that it doubles up in the tone with the symbiote when it's in charge, you know, eating people. I thought those jokes played well, but the tone is really strange.
It is very strange. Yeah. And I don't know, like, overall how this is going to play. I think it's doing really well. Won some weekend or something like that, or broke some record, I've heard. And I think that this is the exact kind of movie that critics are going to hate, but general audiences are mostly going to like. And I'm somewhere in the middle. Like, I'm fine with it existing. It could probably go either way on a second round. But I'm not mad at it.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's a good spot to be in. I wanted to see more of Emilio Rivera. He was hardly in it at all. The lobby guard.
Let's go ahead and get into the Netflix homework, the last segment here, and I will let you describe to me what happens in The Ritual.
Oh, okay. So plot summarize The Ritual. All right. Well, as an initial salvo, The Ritual follows the structure and the pattern of the early 2000s Neil Marshall film The Descent, pretty closely.
Yeah.
It's a male version of The Descent in a lot of ways. So it's instigated.
I was thinking sort of The Descent meets Blair Witch a little.
Yeah, with the Wicker Man thrown in there for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got five guys at the beginning who are goofing around. They're out of a pub. Two of them go into a liquor store. One of them ends up being killed in a liquor store robbery. The other one, the protagonist eventually named Luke, doesn't do anything. He's sort of frozen, doesn't help his friend out. And so then we get our title sequence. And 6 months later, the lads are off on the trip that they were talking about earlier to Sweden, where they're going to go hiking, which nobody really wants to do, but they're honoring their friend. So the film kicks off when they establish a sort of cairn memorial in a Swedish hill, trying to get to their next place. The guy that nobody likes, Dominic, injures himself. So they have to figure out how they're going to get there. They decide to shortcut through a forest. Shit goes crazy. For a while, it seems like it's going in a very Blair Witchy direction. Then it shifts to a very Wicker Man-y direction at the end, and then you have ends up in an odd sort of overly optimistic resolution, kind of like the American ending to The Descent in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I thought about that movie a lot, not just because this is an English film or European movie about a bunch of people getting lost in the woods or whatever, but it sort of also has elements of you could go all the way as far back as The Thing, since we were talking about that before. It has elements of that, a little bit of sort of them losing trust in each other and sort of a paranoia that sort of brews between them. And is there really something in the woods, or are they just going insane? They play around with that for a little bit. I was actually pretty happy with how most of this turned out.
Yeah, I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Yeah, and this was your pick for me. So was this the first time you'd seen it, or was this something you'd seen that you thought might as well?
No, my wife had watched it and tried to get me to watch it for quite a while, and I kept putting it off. And then you said, find something horror on Netflix. And so I gave in and said, I'll watch that movie. We can talk about it. And so I kind of just wandered into it by happenstance without knowing much about it. But I mean, I'm glad that's what it turned out to be.
One of the things I like about the movie, and what I like about any horror movie with this kind of setup, is they put a lot of work early on into the character stuff. So we really get to know these five individuals within the first three or four scenes before the genre stuff starts happening. And the horror is often played alongside the emotional storytelling. They keep going back to that scene in the bodega. There's like two this weirdly podcast. We have two movies where there's a murder that takes place in a bodega, but yeah, they keep going back to that over and over again and sort of playing it for, you know, psychological purposes. And I think all of that stuff plays really well. I think actually the acting all around, I'm not super familiar with any of these actors. I've probably seen them in, you know, various British television somewhere, but all of them are very convincing. All of them play their role. And I think that there, this happens every once in a while where, you know, you see a very traditional like horror movie setup of like a bunch of people in the woods, weird shit's happening. But very rarely do the people in the horror movie talk about what's happening in terms of this is like a horror movie, because which is exactly what I would do if I was stuck in, you know, if all this stuff was happening, I'd be like, oh, my God, we're going to get Blair Witched right now. And they don't say that exactly, but they do kind of point out like this is all really fucked up and scary. Let's try and get out of this as soon as we can. So they seem a little bit more self-aware. You know, a lot of horror movies where the human beings are just monster fodder to get killed later.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so I work in the English department, right? So most of the people around here study literature and what have you. In talking with people who had seen this film recently about it, there's a pretty big, we had a pretty reasonable consensus about reading this as a film about trauma, trauma theory. In terms of literature, which suggests that literature is a way to understand psychological trauma and recovery and what have you.
And grief, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of my colleagues has a British, I want to say husband, maybe boyfriend. Anyway, I'll check into that later. Anyway, she read this movie as a film about, a trauma film specifically, but having to do with British identity, ideas of British masculinity specifically.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so many of the things that, that result by the end of the film are the result of people's individual problems going into the film. And then where they transgress from British masculine identity is when they become punished or sought out by the whatever it's called. I don't think it gets a name in the film.
The demonic elk.
The demonic elk. Yeah. So you've got, for instance, the Hutch, the sort of most... male masculine reading character. His problem is hubris, and Phil, the one of the other characters who shows up naked fairly early on, he's the one who wants to talk about what's going on in a very unmasculine, un-British way. And you've got the main character Luke, who has abandoned his colleague at the beginning. He's left a man behind, essentially. So she's reading this as all of these things that happen to them are essential punishments for violating their national and gender identities in some ways, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it sounds like a good paper.
Sure, I'm not going to write it, but yeah, it was a fun way to watch it.
Yeah, no, totally. I don't think you have to know specifically about British culture to get all of that. I mean, that definitely illuminates that a little bit more for me. But I think, you know, the idea that they have these character flaws that are being played against them as they go deeper and deeper into these woods and stuff gets stranger and stranger. I like a good dark horror film like this. I like fun horror. I like pop horror. And I like movies like this too, that are a little bit more psychological and a little bit more bleak. Now, I actually thought that the ending was just hopeful enough. I didn't think that it went overly optimistic, and maybe it was a little convenient in some of how some things work out. But in a way, I thought that it tied in really nicely towards, you know, his survivor's guilt at the beginning of the movie. And so I thought there was a thematic purpose to that sort of optimism. But I was actually pretty happy with this. And I didn't know going into it. I looked it up after I watched it, but it's directed by David Bruckner, who also did another film or was collaborated in another film that I really liked called The Signal, which came out all the way back in 2007, which was sort of this triptych about a radio signal that turns everybody crazy and turns everyone against each other. This is like pre The Purge, and in my opinion, a lot better than those movies.
This is his first directing credit, I think, but he wrote segments of VHS as well.
Yeah, which are a lot of fun. I think he may have directed a couple a segment or something from that as well. And I think that this has a feel of sort of that new wave of like indie horror, stuff like Ty West Your Next? Adam Wingard?
That sounds right.
Yeah, has a little bit of a feel of those kind of guys. The other collaborators in VHS. I think it actually plays pretty well, especially for a direct to Netflix thing, which is such a hot or cold, shot in the dark kind of experience these days. I think this is probably one of the better things I've seen off of the platform.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it made it into a list of films I'll watch a bunch of times, I'm sure, down the road. For one thing, the monster design, the creature design is fantastic. I mean, it really looks amazing.
And it's so rare that we get something that's kind of original, like isn't sort of just a take on something else we've seen. Like, you know, it's a little bit of The Thing meets a little bit of Alien, and then he has a horn or something like that. Like, this actually feels like something, like they really designed something unique and very specific to this landscape.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit Guillermo del Toro, but not in a bad way.
No, and obviously this is probably a low-budget film, so they hide the monster a great deal, which I think in the end sort of works to the movie's benefit, because you don't want to, like, overexpose that really early on. And I think that, you know, what you build in your imagination augments what we end up seeing later. I think just as far as, like, a cool guys in the woods get tortured by demonic elk movie, this is a pretty good one.
Absolutely, maybe the best.
And just to close this review out, what subgenre of metal is this movie?
Obviously it's Viking metal.
Oh, okay, yeah, which is like black metal adjacent.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. A little bit more pagan than satanic, but yeah.
Sure, it could straddle. It's sort of like later career Borzum, probably.
Before or after the white nationalism?
I don't know if that's going to factor in, but certainly, post-Satanist, pro-pagan, somewhere in there.
Yeah, pre-in jail, pre-YouTube videos.
Maybe even one of the jail albums, I don't know.
Maybe. All right, cool. You said you mentioned maybe before we started that you have a podcast. Why don't you tell people about that?
Well, we're on a extended hiatus right now because we all have both of us, Robert and myself, we have a lot of papers to grade and things like that. But it's called Popery, and we haven't put out an episode for quite a while. But we essentially pick a random date from our lifetimes, much like the Quantum Leap setup. Then we just look at what movies came out during that month of that year, what books came out, what songs were on the charts, and just talk about whatever, and video games, whatever we want to talk about.
Cool. And what is it called again?
Popery.
Okay. And how would somebody find that? Like, is it on all of the things?
Yeah, you can find it on iTunes. And probably on, I think we were on Stitcher as well.
Okay.
But I don't remember. We're revamping the thing going forward here. So look in the next few months for new iTunes drops there.
Okay. I will link what you have now in our show notes so people can find it. And if do you have a Twitter account, something like that?
Yeah, sure. So you can just find me at Arthur Denu from Hitchhiker's Guide, Arthur Denu. On Twitter.
All right, cool. And, you know, I'm sure if you post future episodes, you'll do so there as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there anything else you want to promote before I say all my things?
Make sure to vote.
Yeah, November 6th.
That's all I got.
And make sure you're still registered, because sometimes you don't know.
That's true. That's a good point.
If you thought you did it, do it again. All right. You can find us, or you can contact us on our email at jabberandthedrone@gmail.com. You can find me individually at BC Cassidy on Twitter. You can find the show's Twitter at Jabber Podcast. You can also find us on Instagram at Jabber Podcast. You can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/Jabber Podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play. You can also find Keith over on his Instagram and Twitter at Keith Foster Kid, I think. And he's going to come back on the next episode and talk about the 90s, 90s horror films. And we'll be reviewing something. I'm not sure what yet. And be sure to listen to our friends out there who also do podcasts, Dennis and Patrick over at Almost Educational, Rod and Moksha over at The Listening Party, Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums Podcast, Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places. I know Alice also has a Star Wars Rogue One specific fan cast, and I think it's called Rogue Fun Star Wars Podcast or something like that. Look it up. The Adamant Podcast and Campfire Shit Show. And I think that is the episode.
All right.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on, and thanks for geeking out with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Talk to you later.